Welcome, everyone. We're going to get started. My name is Nicole Castillo, and I'm going to be the MC for this panel today. I'm thrilled to be here to support the advancement of women and to support our community. The company that I helped to co-found, Be Visible, believes in making visible all of the successes of young women. So Glennon is a huge, huge inspiration for the work that we do because we believe that by being your truest self, all of your flaws, that's how you're going to become the best leader. The Conference on Women offers a blend of practical tools and services, inspiration, and peer networking. Through a mix of sessions, we are committed to your empowerment to inspire you to make your mark in companies, careers, and communities. Thank you for participating in the session. Embrace your messy, beautiful life, a fireside chat with love warrior Glennon Doyle Melton. Now I'm going to introduce our speakers. Interviewing Glennon today is Emily Reamer.
Emily!
Hey!
Good morning. Who is up with us this morning? Maybe some one hand. I love you.
Emily is an award-winning journalist for WCVB. She is a co-anchor for News Center 5 Eye Opener and also serves as News Center 5's medical reporter. Before her time at WCVB, Reamer originally worked at WSYX-TV and WTTE-TV in Columbus, Ohio, where she served as a political reporter and news producer. Through her distinguished career, Reamer has reported on a range of stories from daily government to public policy. She was invited to interview President Obama as one of only four folks from a local newscast.
Nice. Thank you.
She's a dedicated volunteer, a graduate of Ithaca College and Leeds University of England. Please join me in welcoming Emily. Now on to Glennon. Glennon probably doesn't need an introduction because you're all groupies, but Glennon Doyle Melton is an author of the inspiring and hilarious New York Times best-selling memoir, Carry On Warrior, and number one New York Times best-selling memoir, Love Warrior. She is the founder of Momastery, an online community where hundreds of thousands of readers meet daily to experience her honest and powerful essays about marriage, motherhood, faith, addiction, recovery, and serving the marginalized. She is the creator and president of Together Rising, a nonprofit organization that has revolutionized online giving through love flash mobs and has connected countless families to needs with millions of dollars of critical resources. Glennon became a sensation when her personal essays, which give language to our universal yet often secret experiences, went viral. Her poignant observations have inspired social movements. She's a regular contributor to HuffPost. She's been featured on the Today Show. You probably saw her on Oprah, NPR, The Ladies' Home Journal, Women's Day, Glamour, Parents Magazine. I digress. Okay. Hers is an authentic, empowering, hopeful, and loving voice that inspires the warrior within each of us. Please join me in extending a heartfelt welcome to Glennon Doyle Melton.
Nicole, thank you so much for the lovely introductions. We appreciate it. And thank you all for being here. It's awesome, right? To be with so many
amazing,
inspiring, incredible women.
Yes.
So we're glad you're here. We're glad you made it this morning. So let's get right to it because you only have an hour.
Okay.
Which is ridiculous because we could probably spend a bazillion times that talking. I know.
Yes.
So the word warrior. It is in the title of both of your books. Mm-hmm. The most recent one, Love Warrior, just came out doing incredibly well, hugely successful. Tell us about it.
About Love Warrior?
Yeah.
Okay, so have you guys read it? Has anybody read it? Okay. So, my first book was Carry On Warrior, and that was kind of the story of how my life began. I mean, my life really didn't begin until 15 years ago when I got sober. I became bulimic when I was 10, and that because I've just always kind of been an overachiever and ahead of my time, you know? And so I did that really early. And I never got it. I never healed from it. And so when you don't heal from an addiction, it just morphs into other things. So it just kept morphing into, you know, alcoholism and other unhealthy things. And so I didn't wake up from addiction until I was 25 years old. And I found out I was pregnant with my son, Chase. And because I didn't grow up like other people, you know, when you drop into addiction, you really kind of drop out of growing up. That's, you know, addiction is kind of just a hiding place for sensitive people. And we drop into this little hiding place because the real world feels too scary.
Kind of numbing.
Yeah, completely. Yeah. So, and hiding, you know. And it is a very effective way to hide from pain and love, which is why, you know, the addicts in your life, it feels like you can't reach them. Like there's like a glass wall between you and them. You know, that's purposeful. We're doing that to protect ourselves. And so you do protect yourself from love and pain, but it's also a very sad existence because you don't grow inside of addiction because the only things that grow us are love and pain, right? So so when I came out of addiction and into like smack dab into motherhood, my life just became a process of becoming. I mean, I thought that the way you grow up as a woman is you become things, right? So I became sober, and then I became like vertical, and then I became like an upstanding citizen, and then I became a mother, and then a wife. I know some of you do that in opposite order, but whatevs. And then I became a writer, and then I became a speaker, and then I became an activist. And it felt like I was like this little scared person, but I was putting on all of these like bigger and bigger and more fancy costumes, you know? And that was like how I was becoming a grown-up and making me feel legitimate. And like I was earning my worthiness in this world. And then, so like 4 years ago, I had three kids and a successful career. I was kind of, they sent me out into the world as kind of like a relationships expert, you know, which is hilarious. So so then I'm in therapy one day with Craig. We're just doing some marriage maintenance stuff. And my husband told me in a therapy session that he had been unfaithful to me our entire marriage, right? Bad day. So, and I remember like the therapist looking at Craig, the therapist didn't even know this. And the therapist certainly didn't know that Craig was going to bring it up in this particular therapy session. And I remember the therapist looking at Craig and saying, "Why did you drop this bomb today?" And Craig said, "I've been watching Glennon in her work and I've seen how she tells the truth about who she is and people still love her. And I want to know if I can have that too."
Wow.
So I said, "No."
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Like, I could see where you might try. And I wish you the best in finding that elsewhere. So Love Warrior is kind of, it's just the story of, if Carry On Warrior is the story of my becoming, becoming all the things, then Love Warrior, it's like, in your 30s, you think that the way to grow up is to become things, and then this crap happens to you, and for most of my friends, it's in the 40s, where you realize that's not how you grow up. Like, how you grow up really is unbecoming all that crap, right? To like, it's like we're Russian nesting dolls, you know? And we're like this little perfect beloved creature, but then we start adding these costumes, and we think that's how we're supposed to earn our worthiness, and then one day we can't even find ourselves anymore. So then the universe offers us this opportunity, which usually feels like a horrible tragedy, some kind of crisis, you know? And that is our chance to start taking off those Russian nesting dolls and get back to that little like solid person that we were born to be, that we were meant to be before the world told us who we were supposed to be, you know? So Love Warrior, Carry On Warrior is the story of my becoming, and Love Warrior is the story of my unbecoming. And you guys, I'm telling you what, the unbecoming is painful and confusing and hard, but the end of it is this like fierce freedom at where you just run out of F's to give, you know? And you stop trying to please the entire world, and you stop asking like everybody in your life and every institution in your life who you're supposed to be and what you're supposed to want, and you actually figure out how to go inside and figure out what you want and who you want to be, in the absence of all of those directions, and then you finally become who you were meant to be. And it scares the hell out of the world, okay, because the world runs on us, you know, staying within the lines, because women keep the world running by trying to please the whole world. But it's worth it. It's worth all the backlash. And for me, the process was a lot about becoming a whole person. So when I went to therapy, back to therapy, because when all of the, when the marriage fell apart, I didn't know what else to do but to like start therapy again intensively. I figured out that I was having all kinds of sex issues, like body issues that all started when I was 10 years old. And what happens to a lot of us, you guys, is that, so we're all born whole, right? Body, mind, and spirit. And all body, mind, and spirit are all of those three parts of us, you guys. They're all equally divine. Like equally, our bodies and our spirits and our minds are all these vessels of wisdom that we can use to figure out who we are and what we want. But the thing is that the world gives little girls so many lies and aggressive and shaming messages about our bodies early on, that what we girls do is that we start disassociating from our bodies, right? At some point, we agree with the world that no, our bodies are not these divine vessels of love and wisdom, worthy just because they exist, not because of the shape of them or the size of them. No, we agree with the world that actually our bodies are just objects, right? They belong to the world, they belong to other people, and what we really need to do is beat them into submission in a million different ways. And so we check out of our bodies because we're ashamed of them, because and we can't love or claim something that we're ashamed of. So we vote our bodies off the island of us. And what that looks like, women, is that we care more about how we look than how we feel. Okay? We don't even know what we want anymore because we're too busy trying to be wanted. Right? We don't know what we desire because we just think our job is to be desired. Right? And this not living inside of our bodies makes sex really confusing. It's why I was angry all the time, because if you are not in your body, if you're not attached to your body, then you just feel like you're being used all the time. And so what happens to the little boys, you guys, is they're born whole too, right? Body, mind, and spirit. But the world tells little girls, good girls don't desire. Good girls don't have an appetite. Good girls don't want. And then it tells the little boys, brave boys don't cry. Brave boys don't feel. And so the men vote their emotions off the island of themselves. And then we freaking marry each other. Have mercy. Have mercy on all of us, right? And we're like, why can't we reach each other? Why? Oh, I don't know. Because it's designed that way, right? Because everything we learn about femininity and masculinity makes it almost impossible for real women and real men to love each other. Right? And so relationships have to have an unbecoming also. Right? The only way for a real man and a real woman to love each other is to unlearn every freaking thing our culture has taught them about what it means to be a woman and what it means to be a man. Right? So that, so Love Warriors was that process.
So is your definition then of a warrior, man or woman, someone who has the courage to walk that path, to be true and honest to themselves, you know, no matter what the world or anyone else says? What's your definition of a warrior?
That's a good question. Okay, so it changes all the time. I think my definition of a warrior right now would be, so there's the epigraph of the book is a Joan of Arc quote, right? So it's, I am not afraid, I was born to do this. And so I love Joan of Arc because I have a picture of her in my mind all the time, just sitting on her horse, right? Just rushing straight towards the battle of her life. That's what that's what's badass about Joan of Arc. That's why we are obsessed with her, is I am. I'm obsessed with her, okay? So I love that visual so much because most of us do the opposite thing. Okay? Most of us, we have pain in our lives, right? We have pain, but it's like on the periphery of our knowing. So we know we have stuff internally to deal with. We know we have that addiction. We know we have that denial. We know we have that awful thing that happened to us in the past that we're going to have to revisit if we can go forward. We know, but we just avoid it. We just avoid it. We run away from that battle instead of towards it. Our relationships, we know what the battle is of our relationships, right? We know our husband's cheating. We know our daughter's bulimic. We know our son's addicted to porn. We know this friendship is toxic. We know.
But we get on our horse and we run straight away from it. Because we don't think we can handle what's inside that battle. We think it will kill us. Right? We know what the pain of the world is. We know what breaks our heart about the world, whether it's, you know, racism or misogyny or hunger or starvation or homeless dogs, whatever it is. We know what it is, but we run straight away from it because we think it'll break our heart too much. So the warrior is the woman. I'm sure that men can do it too. I feel done with them. But like, in so many ways. I wish you all well. So the warrior is the woman who gets on her horse every morning and goes directly towards the pain of her personal life. So she deals first with the hard stuff, right? Because she knows that she can take it, right? Like the quote that drives Love Warrior is a Pema Chodron quote, and it's, if you can sit with the hot loneliness for 1.6 seconds today, when yesterday you could only sit with it for one, then that is the journey of the warrior. And what that means to me, you guys, is we all have this hot loneliness inside of us, right? So we have this pain, we have this fear, we have this anger, we have this doubt, but we think that that's a problem to fix. So the second we start feeling our hot loneliness, the world starts showing us easy buttons. Do you guys remember those Staples commercials where the second, like, anything got stressful, this red easy button would come and you could hit it and it would transport you out of that stressful place into this, like, fake pain-free existence? So that's what we do all the time. We feel our hot loneliness and then we look for our easy button. So for me, it's all the things. It's always been all the things. Food, booze, sex, or whatever. But it's different for everybody. It can be shopping. It can be snark. It can be unkindness. It can be denial. It can be apathy. It can be hopelessness. It's usually food. But it can be any of those other things. And you guys, you know what it is now also? Our biggest easy button is scroll, 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 yeah. Right? So the second we start feeling our hot loneliness, our first thought is, you know what I need to do? I need to check on that guy I knew in second grade and see how his vacation to Bermuda is going. And then we're like, oh, whew, I don't even remember what I was stressed about, you know? Right. Which, it works, right? It takes us out of the hot loneliness. It transports us out. But the tragedy is that in the transporting out, we miss all of our transformation. Every time we hit an easy button, we're like caterpillars that jump out of the cocoon right before we would have become butterflies, right? Because everything we need to become the woman that we were meant to be is actually inside of the hot loneliness. So hot loneliness is not a hot potato. Pain is not a hot potato to be gotten rid of the second we feel it. It's a traveling professor, and pain just walks around the world and knocks on everyone's door. And the wisest women I know are the warriors, who say, come in and sit down and don't leave until you've taught me what I need to know. Because nothing will leave us until we've learned the lesson. It will just keep coming back and keep visiting us. And then the second thing the warrior does is this. She rushes towards her pain. The most important lesson that process, the love warrior process, taught me, which was all the pain of that marriage stuff and the unbecoming, is that we women are told so early that the way to be a successful woman is to be selfless. Okay? One day we wake up and we don't have a freaking self to check in with anymore. All we do is ask everyone around us, what should I do? What should I do? Our friends, what should I do? We ask our church, what should I do? We ask our community, what should I do? We pick up magazines, what should I do? Who am I? Who should? Okay. When all of this stuff happened to my marriage, everyone on earth had advice for me. Okay? I think it was actually everyone on earth. Okay? And so in order to stay sane, I had no choice but to find 10 or 15 minutes a day to block out every single voice in my life and be still. Sit in a quiet place in my house and just listen for that voice that every woman has inside of her that will always tell her what the next right thing to do is. I call it God. Most of my friends call it intuition. Many of my friends call it wisdom. I have a friend who has major God issues. She calls it Sebastian. I don't freaking care what you call it. Right? all I care about is that you know how to listen for it. Because you always know what to do. Every time a woman says she doesn't know what to do, she's lying. She knows what to do. She just doesn't want to do the thing that she knows to do. So she has to call all of her friends and say, what do you think I should do? What do you think I should do? What do you think? Because we are amazing pollers, right? Because we don't know how to have a self. So we think the way to decide what to do next is to poll everyone we know and then take a general consensus and then do what the most people told us to do, right? Okay, we don't have to do that. We do not have to do that. All because they don't know. Nobody else knows what you're supposed to do. Because nothing is about right and wrong. What you need to do next has nothing to do with what's right or what's wrong. It has to do with what's precise. Right? What's precisely right for you next. And the only way to do that is to check with yourself inside. So what the warrior woman knows to do is when she doesn't know what to do, she knows that the only one who knows is that still small voice inside of her. Right? Mm-hmm. She knows how to check in with that still small voice, and she knows how to do the next right thing without asking for permission from anyone. And then here's the hardest part, you guys, without explaining herself afterwards. You don't have to explain yourself to anyone ever. You can check in with yourself, you can do the next right thing without asking for permission. And then you can refuse to explain yourself afterwards. You can live like a man. Okay? That's what they do. That's why they have so much leftover energy. Okay? I truly think that not explaining yourself is the final frontier for women. I think the most revolutionary thing a woman can do is just refuse to explain herself. And if you make a mistake, if that thing that you did turns out to be the wrong thing, you can just backtrack and start over. That's like the definition of life. You don't have to be right all the time. You just have to be free. Okay, the end.
That was good. That was good. Go on and on, right? So let's talk a little bit about purpose.
Purpose.
I think in the day-to-day of making the lunches, getting the kids to school, getting to work, coming home, feeding them, getting soccer stuff, it can be hard to think about purpose. What am I doing here? What is my purpose? What is your advice to maybe single in on what that purpose is and how to go after it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's two questions you can ask yourself that I have found help me with that quest for purpose. So I think our purpose here, my purpose here, is to create, to serve, and connect. It's actually really simple. To create some beautiful things, to serve people, and to connect with other people, right? And so there's some questions that I think you can ask yourself to get to the root of those things. So one, I think we're so obsessed with being happy, right? We're always like, what makes me happy? Let's follow my bliss, whatever, that's good. But the thing is, when you ask most women what makes them happy, when you ask me what makes me happy, I'm like, I really like carbs and trash TV. Like, that's what makes me happy, all right?
Yes.
I'm serious, okay? Even I know there's probably, like, more for me down here than that, okay? So what I think might be interesting is if instead of, like, obsessing about what makes us happy, if we got curious about what makes us uncomfortable, right? Because negative, uncomfortable emotions are not mistakes. They are teachers, right? They're traveling professors. Everything uncomfortable is there to teach us, just as much as the joyful stuff is. Okay, so, but we don't, we hot potato the uncomfortable emotions, and so we don't learn from them. So I want to take a look at one of these uncomfortable emotions, envy. Okay, so envy is that thing that we all feel, but we pretend we don't because we don't think we're supposed to, right? We think we're supposed to hot potato envy and pretend we don't have it. So envy for me, what it looks like is somebody sends me an article by like an amazing woman, and the article is like the best thing I've ever read. Like, it's amazing. And at the end of it, I'm like, all right, you know what? I never really liked her. So that's lovely. That's a great way to live. It's like admiration goes in, and then my body does this weird thing to it, and then it just comes out as snark, right? That's what envy is. It's just like admiration that's just holding its breath, okay? So if instead of hot potatoing that envy, I actually learned from it, let me tell you this. When I was drinking all the time, if somebody gave me a book that was written by a woman and said, this book is amazing, you have to read it. I would not read it. I could not read it. I mean, first of all, because it would have been very blurry back then. But secondly, because it was like I could not, there was something inside of me that felt so much pain when I looked at beautiful words that another woman had written, because part of me knew that a healthier, braver, better version of myself could do that. And there is nothing more painful than watching someone do what you were made to do when you're not doing it. Right? So I think it's possible that envy is actually this like arrow pointing us directly towards what we were made to create down here. Because I think we're only envious of people who are creating what we were made to create. I think if you tell me who you are envious of, I will tell you what you were made to do. Hmm. Right? If you can sit with it. If you can be still in that hot loneliness long enough to learn from it. Okay. Create. So we've got that one check. Great. Just tell me who you're jealous of. Okay. Secondly, serve. Okay, so here's a hot potato emotion that I hear every day from people. They write to me with the Together Rising stuff when I tell stories about painful things all over the world that we're going to help fix. I can't go there, it'll break my heart. I can't meet her, it'll break my heart. I can't read that, it'll break my heart. So these are all the Joan of Arcs, like, rushing directly away from the battle of their lives, right? They're hot potatoing heartbreak. Heartbreak is not a mistake. Heartbreak, what breaks your heart is the greatest clue of your life, right? It's like a diamond that's been put inside of your heart that when you discover it, you discover your purpose. Because what breaks your heart is different than what breaks your heart, than what breaks your heart, than what breaks your heart. So when you figure out what specifically breaks your heart about the world, and you don't easy button out of it, but you actually go towards the people who are doing that kind of world healing work in the world, there's your purpose. Okay? We are here to serve, and if you need to figure out who you were meant to serve, all you have to do is ask what breaks your heart in the world. So, create, check. Serve, check. Connect. Okay. Connection is a byproduct of figuring out what you were made to create and who you were made to serve. Because when you go towards those world-healing people doing that work, there's your tribe. Right? Because there is no bond that's greater than the bond that happens between women who are doing the same world healing work together or creating the most beautiful crap together. Okay? So like my tribe are the women who are doing the same artwork that I am doing in the world. And they are the women who are doing the same nonprofit work that I'm doing in the world. Right? And my best tribe member is my sister because she's in both lanes with me all the time. She doesn't have a choice. She's here. Hi, sis. Okay. Tell me who you're envious of, and I'll tell you what you were made to create. Tell me what breaks your heart, and I'll tell you who you were made to serve. And I will promise you that your tribe is in both places. The end. There's your purpose. All done.
Well, that was easy.
Yeah, it's so easy.
Yeah, we could just go home today and get it all sorted out.
Yeah, it's so easy. That's why my life is like done and perfect and awesome and not messy at all right now.
Let's talk about service a little bit more, because this is something I think, I know myself as the mom of two young kids, I would like to do more, to serve more. But, you know, it's hard to find the time. You've said, though, all paths lead to service.
Yeah.
You've established Together Rising. Why is this so important? Why did you become an activist?
Well, I think, first of all, that we get exhausted by the idea of service because we think it's, like, separate from our lives, like something extra we have to do.
Right. Something in the schedule.
And I'm not sure that that's exactly the way it happened for me. I think that we all have gifts inside of us, like every one of us is born with some kind of gift, and that when we use our gift, it's just like this road that we start on, right? We start using our gift, and then no matter what we do, the path always takes us into the service lane.
Okay.
That's like the trick of the world. Okay, like if you start using your gift, you will end up in the service lane if you're doing it right. Like, for example, my job is to be an artist. Okay, my job is to, really the artist's job is just to pay attention. It's just to pay attention to people and things in the world and to try to notice things that other people might be too busy to notice. Okay? Mm-hmm. When you pay really, really close attention to other people and to the world, you automatically fall in love. That's what happens. When you fall in love with humanity and other people, you end up wanting to love them and serve them. So that's what happened, Momastery. I just started falling in love with the world and with this community. And then it just became this like overwhelming desire to serve. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what happened at Momastery. When women, Momastery is a place where women fill up.
Yeah.
We fill up. And then what happens when women are filled up is that they naturally overflow into their communities. It's just, but if you're not overflowing, it's not because you're bad, it's because you're not filled. Right? That's like putting the cart before the horse. If you try to serve while you're empty, you just hate service. It just feels like this burden. But if you start with the filling up, and you don't even think about serving until you're filled,
yeah.
Right? It won't feel right. Like work, right? So the other important thing I think about service is that sometimes being out there as a woman in leadership, I'm sure you haven't noticed this, but it's kind of hard. And it can be really lonely. And the criticism is just unfreaking relent. It's just relentless, and like, there's so much of it. You guys, I'm just traveling all over the place and meeting all of these women leaders in all of their lanes, and all of them are so tired and so lonely. And none of us know what to do, but that's because we don't have anybody in front of us, right? We're all out there, and like, we're just this fields are like lanes are in front of us, and most people have like men have mentors. They have hundreds of years of people who have done what they're doing beforehand, but most of us are doing something new, right? And it's so hard. It's really hard, and it's really scary, and it's really lonely and confusing. And so what happens to a lot of us is that we just get taken out of the game. It's too hard. So what we have to do is we have to attach our professional work to service, to something that's bigger than us, that's bigger than our personal goals. Because that is the only thing that will keep us in the game when our personal lane gets too hard. I have wanted to quit a million times. I've wanted to quit writing, I've wanted to quit speaking, I've wanted to quit leading. And the only reason I don't quit is because my personal work is tied so directly to Together Rising. And Together Rising is saving lives. And it's helping women all over the country. And so I can't quit. I can't be a baby about my hard stuff because it's tied to something bigger than me. Right? So finding something that you got to find a group of women who are doing world healing work and attach yourself to them so that you won't let yourself get taken out by the hard. And then the other thing, you guys, about the activism, because service is a little bit different than activism. I do not understand. If we're all feminists, I know we're here. We're here because we're feminists. If you're not a feminist, I'm sorry. I don't know what to do with you. Feminism is just like the radical idea that women are human. Okay, so we have got to, you guys. I feel like the only way that power, that you know, well, we'll just say it, that white male power stays in power, is to keep all of the people who are not in power separate from each other. Okay, that is the oldest trick in the book. If we all who are not in power stay afraid of each other and stay siloed and stay separate and do not speak up for each other, status quo will always remain. We need to stay afraid of each other and separate in order for power to never be shared. Okay? So, if we are a white female leader, we had better be speaking out for women of color. Okay? If we are white female leaders, we had better be speaking out for gay rights. I would really appreciate that now if you could do that. If you are a person who feels like you lack power, great, okay? There's lots of other, most people share that with you, right? Most people do. And the way that we will shift power and share power is if all of marginalized people come together and start speaking out for each other, okay? It's part of our duty as women to identify every place where our marginalization intersects with other people's marginalization and find every opportunity to band together and start speaking out for each other and showing up for each other. That's what women do. Okay, go ahead, the end.
The end helps me, actually.
I know.
It keeps me on track.
I know, because I'm like...
I know. No, it helps. This is good. Yeah. This is. Okay. I can suggest that to all of my interviewees right. From now on. If you could finish your question. The end.
Yeah.
This is
sometimes
good.
Interviewers ask me, how will I know when you're done?
The end.
I'm like, I will say the end. Yes.
So you touched on this just a little bit about, you know, it's hard to be a leader and there can be a lot of criticism. Some of it can be really vulgar and mean and nasty. How do you let that, you know, I don't want to say you let it kind of slide off your back. How do you let it not stop you from doing what you're doing?
Okay. Oh God, Lord have mercy. All right. So one thing that is helpful to me with criticism is, first of all, I mean, we know whoever it was, Aristotle or somebody smart, said, you know, the only way to avoid criticism is to do nothing, say nothing, be nothing. Okay, so if you want to avoid criticism, you could choose that path. Do nothing, say nothing, be nothing. Okay? Nobody here is going to do that, so we'll move on. What I think you can do as a woman, if you want to prepare for the onslaught of criticism that will come when you decide to take up the space on this earth that you deserve and that you were born to take up and use the voice you were given, and not stay as small as the world wants you to, right? It is not your duty to stay small so that the world can be comfortable. You can bet, you can write down the kind of criticism you'll get. Okay, so that none of it has to be a surprise. Okay? The world will tell you there's categories of things. Okay, so first of all, one of the things that the world will do to try to put you in your place, first it will criticize your appearance. I do not know why, okay? But you will be too fat to speak. Or you will be too skinny to speak, okay? Or you will have terrible skin, or your hair will be too curly or too straight. Your clothes are terrible. Like you will be too feminine. You will be not feminine enough. There will be a whole category that will attack your looks. Okay, fine, yawn, boring. Moving on. The second round of criticism you will get will be personal to your relationships. Okay, you will definitely be a shitty mom. Okay? I just want you to know that there is no way around that. Okay? Everyone in here is a shitty, shitty mom. Okay? So when they tell you that, you just say, yes, thank you, I agree, yes. Terrible, okay? So that, you will be a bad wife, right? You will be whatever, so that's fine. I mean, come on, we know that's coming, right? And then the third category is that you will be crappy at whatever you do, okay? So your writing will be bad, your work will be bad, you will be a bad leader, you will be a bad boss, you will be a bad, whatever it is, you will be terrible at it, okay? So you are ugly, you're a shitty mom, and you are terrible at your work. Okay, right? That's it. That's the worst they can say. And they will say it, and it'll be every day. So just keep your list by your desk. Every single thing that comes at you, you'll be able to categorize in one of those things and then dismiss, okay? Nothing will be new other than that. If you are putting work out into the world, this is how I think of my work as an artist. My job is to create things, okay? So what I see happening, so many of us do our work on the internet now, or at least we promote our work on the internet, or we interact on the internet, and so one of my rules for that is that I see so many artists letting criticism or judgment of their work take them out of the game. And I think this is why it happens. If you do not have a rule for yourself, that your job is to create and release, okay? So whether that's a meeting or for me it's an essay or whatever it is, my job is to create something and then give it to the world, release. My job is not to babysit what I just created. And what that looks like is following around my essays all over the internet and making sure everyone's understanding them and no one's misjudging them and and everyone likes it, okay? And that no one's misreading me or defending it, being a lawyer for what I just created, okay? Because I am not a babysitter. I am a creator. And when I see artists allowing the criticism and the judgment to take them out of the game, it is not because they are not artists, it's because they're not babysitters, right? Because they're spending too much energy defending or taking care of what they just created instead of releasing it and making something new. That's your job, to go out and make something imperfect. It might even suck. Okay? Release, make something new. That's your whole job. No defending, no babysitting, no lawyering. And when you get really tired, it's not because you're not a creator, it's because you're not a lawyer. If you're a lawyer, I don't know what you do. Just keep lawyering. I'm not sure. Maybe there's another breakout session for that. Your sister's a lawyer. Okay, anyway, distracted. So, I don't know, you guys. I think that no matter what we do as women, we are going to be criticized for it. Right? And I think if you're being criticized, since the rules for girls and women are to stay small, right? To stay smaller and smaller in body, in idea, in dream, in voice, quieter and quieter and smaller until you just disappear. If you are being criticized, it is because you are not doing those things, right? It is because you're not being small in voice. It's because you're not being small in idea. It's because you're not being small in dream. And so if you're being criticized, then I think you might be doing something right. The end.
Okay. All right, how about a round of applause right now? I could ask you questions.
Yes.
For the next month or so.
Yeah.
So maybe I'll just, you know, send you an email.
Perfect.
Later. Okay, deal. But I think you guys should have a chance to ask some questions. So we have some microphones set up here in the aisles. And if you'd like to come down and ask a question, Nicole's going to kind of moderate that portion of it. But
and our only rule for questions, you guys, is that actually has to be a question. Okay? So we don't do stories during this time because we just don't.
I'll start us off with one question. So, Glennon, you said that yoga was a huge part of your healing. I'm wondering for folks that maybe feel like strapped for time or resources, what's one thing we can do to build our sustainability?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so you make your list of things that keep you sane. So for me, I have a list of my easy buttons, which are things that take me away from myself. Okay, so booze, overeating, I have a whole list, easy buttons. But then I have my reset buttons. Yeah. Okay, so life is, I don't know if you guys noticed, but life is like really hard, okay? So maybe every 45 minutes I start to think it's too hard. I'm not kidding. Maybe I'm amazing for 40 minutes, right?
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. This sucks and I hate it. So I've got my reset buttons on a list in my office. And these are things, you guys, that are so simple. They're like, Glennon, when you feel like everything's crashing down and you think the only answer is to like change your family, change your religion, change your all the things, really you just need a freaking glass of water. Right? It's always like the small thing. So it's like, Glennon, drink a glass of water. Glennon, play with the dogs for 5 minutes. Glennon, walk to the corner and back. You guys, walking to the corner and back for me, different person, right? They're always like these small little things, but you have to list them and keep them close because when life gets too hard, it's too late, right? Pantry, straight to the pantry, okay? So if I'm tired and trying to figure out what's gonna help me, straight to the pantry. But if I have my list, then I can remember, walk to the corner. And then I always say, and then I can go to the pantry if I still need to, right?
Right.
List it out.
We'll start over here, if you'd like to ask your question.
Hi. My name is Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
I just wanted to say, so I have been following Momastery for about 5 or 6 years now, and yours was, I would say, the first door to my authenticity that I opened.
Mm.
Sorry, I'm going to get a little emotional. And the second door that I opened to my authenticity was through postpartum progress.
Mm.
I have 2 children. And after my second, depression and anxiety really took over.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that throughout my life I had been experiencing those. And I just wanted to know if you would talk a little bit about those mm-hmm. sort of awakenings, because they are traveling professors, and mm-hmm. I love the way that you put that. And then talk about, you know, you preference this actually in your question about self-care mm-hmm. and how we can really be aware of what we need and be attuned to it and listen to it and not just keep shoving it down and saying, mm-hmm. I've got my to-do list, I've got to do this, you know, mm-hmm. especially for the women leaders in the room, mm-hmm. I think it's really important because we tend to do that.
Yeah. Okay, so first of all, depression. I love depressed people. Okay, I do. These are my people. And I feel like depression is horribly painful and terrible. I know that. I know this personally. Depression can also be a gift, okay? So do you guys know the story about like the coal miners a long time ago and how they would go down into the mines and there were all these like toxins in the air and their bodies weren't sensitive enough to register the toxins, so they would bring a canary down with them to the coal mines, and the canary's body was built more sensitively like yours. And that was purposeful because it could register the toxins in the air more. So what would happen eventually is the canary, when the toxins got too high, the canary would die. And then they would know to get out of the mine. So this is before PETA, because ixnay on the inari kit. Okay. I'm not saying I support. I'm just reporting. I don't want you to tweet me about the canaries. Okay. So I truly, truly believe that the world is the mines and that some of us are canaries, right? And it's not just a belief, it's like a way of the world. Like in most cultures and in most histories, in times in history and now in most cultures, the canaries in the cultures are identified, they're revered, they're known by the tribes, they are the shaman and the medicine men and the seers and the healers and the clergy and the poets. So they're people that maybe are a little bit different. But they're a little eccentric, they're a little weird, but they serve a really unique purpose in the culture because they can see things other people can't see, and they can hear things other people can't hear, and feel things that other people can't feel. And so in most cultures, people use them as prophets, but in our culture, we are so obsessed with faster and efficient, more efficient, that canaries are really, really inconvenient. So instead of, so we just call them broken and put them away instead of considering that they might be healthy and responding to a broken world, okay? So these are the people who are like standing on the bow of the Titanic yelling, iceberg, iceberg, and everyone else is like, we just want to keep dancing, okay? So like that's what happened to me as a young kid. Like I was like a canary, you know, I was just responding to all these toxins that were not only in my family, but so if you want to know if your family has toxins, spoiler alert, the answer is yes, 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 yes. Okay. Cause we're all human. So all of our families are jacked up. Okay. But they didn't know that before, so they just put the canaries away, right? You just, we'll send that one to therapy, she's broken. Like, now the mental health community is caught up with that. So we bring the canaries in with the whole family, and we say, let's try to find the toxins in the air that this canary is acting out, is responding to. And then if it's not there, let's look at the wider culture, right? For example, we look at little girls who won't eat or are jacked up with food, and we're like, oh my God, what's wrong with them? Like, where could they possibly be getting these messages? Maybe from everywhere on the face of the earth, right? What's wrong with them? They're mentally ill. No, they're responding actually exactly appropriately to the messages that the entire media and the entire culture and all religious institutions and everyone has given them. First story I ever learned, you guys, as a religious person. Okay, there's God. God made these two people, Adam and Eve. God put them in a garden. By the way, Adam gave birth to Eve. Let's not ask any questions about that, even though that's the first man in the history of the entire world to have a woman. Fine. All right? We'll give him that too, okay? Then the woman wanted something. She was hungry and she wanted something. So she went for what she wanted and then the whole world went to shit. Good luck, girls! I don't know, why are they jacked up about food? Maybe because the first one who ate a frickin' apple. I'm so sorry, I forgot your freaking question. Oh, no, I'm with you. Okay, depression. So, my point is that it is possible that you are not depressed because there's something wrong with you, okay? It is possible that we get depressed because there are very real toxins in the air that we are responding to, okay? Every time a woman feels bad, she thinks there's something wrong with her. But sometimes there's just something wrong. Right? for all of us, there's just often something wrong. There's nothing wrong with you. You're not broken. You could be just responding to a broken world. Okay? I think that depression, while extremely painful and terrifying for me every time, is one of the reasons I'm a good artist. Because when depression comes into my life, it's like I spend all of this time building, building, building. I'm building my wisdom. I'm building my ability. I'm building, building, building. And then depression comes in, it's an erasing of everything that I am, everything that I believe, everything that I know. I'm just nothingness, right? Just I'm nothing. And then if I can hang in there long enough, I come out of it. And then what happens when you come out of depression is, since you've forgotten everything you've ever known, you start over with this like beginner's mind, okay? This is what spiritual gurus go to freaking mountaintops to get, beginner's mind. And we get it for free because we get to be mentally ill. Right? So, don't tweet that either. So, what I'm saying is that I really believe that everything is a gift. And I also believe that you don't have to freaking be on all the time. Even plants only bloom in a season. You can be depressed for a while. You can let yourself get out of the game. Right? And you can let it pass and you can start over. You don't have to fight it so much. You can just be still in that valley and let it leave you with whatever you need to climb the next mountain. Is that cool? Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, I love you.
Thank you for being big.
The person in the back?
Very quick question. You said that service and activism are not the same thing, and I just wanted you to elaborate on that.
Yeah, thank you for that question. I mean, I don't know. I think we kind of serve the people that are around us, right? I mean, I know for Together Rising, we serve, people ask us for help. We believe that women know what they need. So we don't have a specific mission in terms of, like, we're going to get you, you know, diapers, or we're going to get you. We don't have a thing that we're trying to get to you. What we're trying to do is you tell us what you need, because we trust women, right? So we're first responders. You come to us, you tell us what we need, we will do our diligence, and then we will get you what you need, because every study on earth has shown us that the way to get a family or a community or a nation rising is to help one woman at a time. That's it. Like, there is, I don't know what the guys are doing with the money, but all I'm saying is that it is, over and over again, domestically and internationally, proven that one woman at a time is the way to do it. Activism for me is a more seeking out, right? So what happened to me in terms of my activism is that the Charleston shootings happened. And for whatever reason, I was freaking asleep before Charleston. And I'm so embarrassed about it. I don't know why. I just thought that since my life as a white woman was pretty good and fair, that that must be how it is for everyone. I'm fine. I'm sure everyone else is too. Okay? And then Charleston happened, and I was sitting with my girls, and we were looking at some pictures of some old civil rights marches. And Tish said to me, "Mommy, if we were, if the little girls, if we were alive back then, would we have been marching?" And I almost said yes. Like, yes almost came out of my mouth. And Emma looked at Tish, and she said, "No, we wouldn't have been marching then. I mean, we're not marching now." And I was like, damn. Like, what if the best indicator of how we would have shown up in the last civil rights era is how we are freaking showing up in this civil rights era, which is exactly as necessary and urgent as that one was, right? So listen to what I did, because I want you to know what an idiot I am. Okay, so I was like, oh my God, I need to like be a freaking civil rights activist. Like, what have I been doing, right? So then I figured out I have arranged my life in such a way that I'm not even friends with any freaking black people. I don't know any black people. I don't even know what to ask them. I don't know how to have conversations. I don't know how to start, because I don't have any black friends. So then this is what I did, you guys. I got on Facebook to my 700,000 followers and said, "Hi, are there any black people who want to be my friend?" That's not the right thing to do. But listen to me, Because I was willing to be stupid and do it wrong, this group of women of color, I don't know, they saw these insane posts I was making, and they somehow just like, were like, dude, she's an idiot, but we think she might have a good heart, and like, I'm not kidding. They banded together, they reached out to me, and they were like, come here. She, first of all, shh. Second of all, we're gonna talk to you, okay? So by the way, these women of color who are freaking spending most of their time trying to keep their kids not shot are helping this white woman figure out how to not be an idiot, okay? So just that act of freaking resilience and grace is insane, okay? So I just started meeting with them every week, like we started to have this Google chat. The first one, I was like, I don't know, I'm just like this white person, and I don't know what's going on, and I just need some help, and my family's very white, and we just don't, you know, and so they're like looking at each other on the Google chat, and one of them types, should we tell her? And I'm like, what is going on? Like, first of all, I don't know how to type, do this, so I feel like you're having a conversation without me. I'm white, so I'm very fragile, okay? And one of the ladies goes, okay, honey, your family's not white. Your children are Asian. You have a family of color. I was like, oh my God, I don't even know if my own family is a family of color. Like, this is amazing. We are so diverse. So that's how it started. And you guys, this is what I did. Through their guidance, I have changed a lot of things. Like, I figured out most of our consciousness is formed by our social media feeds nowadays. So we will believe, like, the first 50 articles that we read that day or whatever will become our consciousness. So it, now I changed up my whole feed. So the first 10 posts I see every morning are from women of color. And my whole consciousness has changed, right? Because I'm, like, experiencing things just a tad the way that they're experiencing things. I'm starting to see the world the way they're seeing the world, and everything's changing, and it's beautiful and amazing and wonderful. And my, you know, there's the, with activism, it's like, great. It's not because you're a good person. It's because your life gets better, right? These women have made my life better. I like them. They're amazing, and they're fierce, and they've put a lot of things in perspective for me. And listen, you guys, like, the thing that happens with activism is that you think you're helping other people, and then they're helping you. Like, I've been kind of entering that world and trying to do the best I can and make it huge, and I'm okay with screwing up. So, like, when you start to speak out to your white friends about, because that's our job, I think, is to, as white people, is to start to kind of educate the best we can other white people, right? So I think that the black people are very busy trying to stay alive and things. So we're not supposed to ask them what to do. We're supposed to talk to our white audiences about white privilege. And then we're supposed to use our platforms to bring black voices to our platforms and amplify them. Right? Those are two things that we can do. And then what happened, you guys, is that recently I came out as gay. Do you guys know that? Ba-bam! Okay. If you didn't, just catch up with me right now. You there? Okay, great. So it's so interesting because when you do that, when something I'm not saying you're going to be gay, whatever. All I'm saying is at some point, you're going to find out that you are part of a group that's screwed. Okay? Like, we all enjoy our privilege until we find out that they're after us too, in some way or another. And then what happens is all of the people that you spoke out are like, all right, it's your turn. Here we are. Here we are. That's what's happened to me during this time. It's amazing. So I think that my rules for activism are be brave and be willing to do it wrong. And then when you get corrected, don't be a baby about it. All right? Because usually what happens with us is that we say something and we're so proud of ourselves and we're like, we did it. And then somebody comes around and is like, you said it wrong. Like, for sure that'll happen to me after this speech. Okay? For sure. And then my job is to stay open and listen and do better next time, but do next time soon. Don't be a baby about it. Okay? Is that a good answer?
It was very enjoyable.
I'll take it. I'll take it.
I'm so sorry, but this will be our last question. I'll take it from this side.
Thank you. I know I'm supposed to use my voice even if it shakes, and lately it's been shaking a lot, so this means a lot to me. I'm a writer and a poet, and I feel like I'm stuck in a loop because every time I go forward and try to finish something, I feel like I get in my own way because my biggest fear is fear of success. And I have people that have told me, you're an amazing writer, you need to do this. And then I'll just like go to the pantry, like you said, and eat myself and get in my own way and then shut myself down. Because every time I've taken a step forwards, my life has exploded, like 7 years of Lyme disease and things like that. So how do you get over the fear?
Mm-hmm. Oh, Lyme disease. I have that. Sorry.
I can tell you how to fix it.
Yeah. No, Lyme disease is one of the best things that ever happened to me because I almost died.
Yeah, me too.
And then really a woman has to almost die to give herself permission to do what the hell she wants to do and to take care of herself.
And it made me be in my body. It forced me to be in my body and deal with the pain.
Yeah. So, I mean, it sounds to me like you're thinking really big and that's your problem, right? So really, if you're an artist and you're a poet and you're a writer, your job is to have your ass in your chair for what, 2 hours a day?
Something like that.
Right.
Although
and then
I work
write something,
a different job, so.
And then write something and then let it go.
Yeah, and I do that on Facebook and stuff, but I feel like everybody keeps asking me when my book's coming out and it's already written, but I just can't put it together and get it out there because I'm so afraid of it being out there in a bigger way, you know, because I feel like I'm stuck at that level and it's been there for like 3 years now. Mm-hmm. And
okay, so you're just caving
I mean,
to the fear voice.
I finally started the blog part, but it's how do I get to the next
So,
spot?
I mean, everybody on Earth's question is, do you want to be safe or do you want to be brave? This is not complicated. I understand that you think it's complicated, okay? But it actually is utterly not complicated. If you're worried about your fear, what I will tell you is that you will be scared every day for the rest of your life.
I usually am, and then I reach for the cookies.
Right, well, because you're a canary, okay?
Yeah.
So you're going to be very scared for the rest of your life every day. That's never going to go away. The only thing you have to decide is there are two voices inside of you, right? And one is fear and one is courage. I call it love. Fear and love. Both of them will constantly be speaking to you every day. You just have to decide which one you're going to take direction from. But this one's never going to stop telling you what not to do. You just have to decide if fear is the boss of you or if courage is the boss of you.
Thanks.
Right? And if you keep letting fear be the boss of you, then 10 years from now you'll be like, oh, and I have these poems and I didn't. Da, 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 da. So you take it worst case scenario. So what's the worst case scenario? You do your book, you put it out there, it bombs, it sucks, everybody hates it. So you put your book out there. So you put your book out there, it does amazing, you become the most famous woman in the world. Okay. Play it all the way out. What can't happen is that you cannot be on your deathbed wishing that you had done the thing that courage told you to do. That's the only thing that you cannot have let happen.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Emily, thank you for being a wonderful interviewer. And thank you, Glennon, for sharing with us your gift of vulnerability. It inspires and empowers all of us.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Love you.